The president's top economic advisor is on the way out.
So who's going to take his place?
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
Yes, and I'm Bill Radke, and it's the midday update from Marketplace.org for Wednesday, September 22nd. A new study says Americans are pretty much clueless when it comes to energy savings. Free fizz for the French at the local drinking fountain, and the Chilean miners get some PR training. But first,
he's the latest administration official to announce his resignation. The White House announced late yesterday that Larry Summers, the president's top economic advisor, will be heading back to Harvard at the end of the year. He joins budget director Peter Orszag and top economist Christina Romer as those who won't see 2011 at the White House. Marketplace's Elisa Roth joins us from our New York bureau to talk about it. Good morning, Elisa.
Good morning.
So the president's economic team has been widely criticized from everything from the handling of the financial crisis to unemployment. Republicans have called for Larry Summers and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner to both be fired. Is that what's going on here?
No. The official story, at least, is much tamer than that. Summers reportedly always planned to leave at some point. He has to be back at Harvard by January or lose his tenure there. And his family is still in Cambridge. What's true is that there's often a big exodus from the White House around the midterm elections, which on the one hand means a lot of uncertainty. On the other hand, it gives the president a chance to make some changes.
So what kind of changes are we talking about here?
Well, there's a lot of speculation that Obama will pick either a woman or somebody from the business world or a woman from the business world as Summers' replacement. This morning, I spoke to a woman named Amy Siskind. She's president of the New Agenda, which is a national organization that aims to promote women. She mentioned two possible candidates who fit that last profile. One is Zoe Cruz, who used to be president of Morgan Stanley. The other is Ursula Burns, who's CEO at Xerox.
There's two women leaders who, you know, have succeeded, been able to work well with others. These are women who have been through and led through times of economic peril.
Other names that have been mentioned are Laura Tyson, who's a former Clinton advisor, and Rebecca Blank, who's in the Commerce Department.
Marketplace's Elisa Roth reporting from New York. Elisa, thanks.
You're welcome.
We say good morning now to economist Richard DeKayser of Woodley Park Research. He's with us live every Wednesday from Washington, D.C. Good to talk to you, Richard.
A pleasure.
First, the White House budget director leaves, then the top economist, now the guy who coordinates economic policy. Is this a huge change?
I don't think so. And, you know, if you look at them individually, Christina Romer left the top job as Council of Economic Advisors, but they brought in a guy named Austin Goolsbee, who was with the Obama administration before it was the Obama administration. He was the chief advisor when they were just running a campaign. So I think to determine whether there's a tide shift going on here, we're going to have to see who he puts in that position. Interestingly, two names have been bandied about: Ann Mulcahy, former CEO of Xerox; Laura Tyson, who actually held the position of chief economic advisor in the Clinton administration after a Republican rout at midterm elections. Both of those names would signal to me that they're willing, or at least posturing, to work with the diminished majorities and possibly loss of majorities in Congress after the midterm elections.
Richard, tell me if I'm wrong. It feels like we're at a crossroads. Is it time now to fight inflation or deflation? Time for stimulus or deficit reduction? Which way do we go?
Well, time will tell for sure. But you're right. Those cross currents, I think, are very typical of moments like this. The economy's out of the recession, as we suspected and were officially notified on Monday. But it hasn't been booming. So in that kind of a mixed economy, you're going to get mixed signals. We've seen some signs of strength, some signs of weakness. The Federal Reserve said they're prepared to help if necessary. If necessary is the key phrase. I don't think we're going to need it. I think deficit reduction is going to be the order of business as the new Congress takes shape. Time will tell for sure, but you can hold me to that when we talk in a few months.
We'll do that. Economist Richard DeKayser of Woodley Park Research. Thank you.
My pleasure.
In Washington today, Jack DeCoster is telling a congressional committee he was horrified to learn eggs from his facilities may have made thousands of people sick. As many as 1,600 were contaminated with salmonella. DeCoster blames an outside supplier for selling his company a tainted ingredient. But his farm operations have a long history of controversy. Iowa Public Radio's Kathleen Masterson has this profile.
Jack DeCoster grew up in abject poverty in Turner, Maine, says his childhood friend and neighbor Ralph Caldwell. Caldwell says DeCoster's father died when he was 12 or 13, and he took over running the small poultry operation to support his family.
He came up the hard way by working hard and taking god-awful chances.
By the time DeCoster graduated from high school, he'd grown the operation from 200 hens to nearly 10,000. As his business expanded, DeCoster donated money to build a Baptist church in his hometown and supported other community projects in Iowa.
And he's a born-again Baptist, but that don't count on Monday, though. That counts on Sunday. On Monday, he's a ruthless businessman.
The state of Iowa classified DeCoster as a habitual violator of environmental regulations in 2000. He was banned from expanding his farms or starting new ones for 5 years, but he got around this by acquiring permits using other associates' names. At today's congressional hearing, the subcommittee has requested that DeCoster present inspection records for his facilities and documentation of past violations. In Ames, Iowa, I'm Kathleen Masterson for Marketplace.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, September 22nd. I'm Bill Radke. If you want to take a look at the markets that's up to date, we have it for you at The Numbers. It's at marketplace.org. The lights are going out this week, literally in Winchester, Virginia, at General Electric's last big U.S. factory making incandescent bulbs. The lighting Americans have used for the past century has been mandated out of existence within the next few years, and GE is moving manufacturing for next-generation CFL, or compact fluorescent light bulbs, to China. Here's Marketplace's senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
GE's founder once said, "Genius is 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration." That may be what Thomas Edison put into his first electric light bulb, but today he'd need to factor in legislation because of what happens by 2014.
Incandescent lights will essentially be illegal. They won't meet minimum efficiency requirements.
David Kreutzer is energy policy analyst at the Conservative Heritage Foundation. He says the fate of 200 GE workers now losing their jobs was sealed 3 years ago when President Bush signed a new energy law. GE says demand is already down by half and that retrofitting to make the new bulbs is too costly. President Obama insists green jobs are the future of America and last month blamed some in Congress for not getting rid of tax breaks for shipping jobs overseas.
They should have to explain why they think these clean energy jobs are better off being made in Germany or China or Spain.
Kreutzer says it has more to do with the added labor to make those twisty bulbs being cheaper overseas. He argues it's proof that being green isn't going to be easy for American workers.
It's no big surprise to me and most economists, but the truth now comes out.
Proponents argue the new bulbs are not only more energy efficient, but last longer. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
You know, this isn't going to sound very nice, but most of us have no clue when it comes to energy savings.
That doesn't sound very nice.
It's not really. But it's the basic finding of a recent study out of Columbia University. Marketplace's sustainability reporter Adrian Hill is with us now in the studio to talk about where a lot of us are getting it wrong. Good morning, Adrian.
Good morning, Steve.
So what the study found is that when it comes to energy savings, we're all idiots?
Yeah, pretty much. Basically, researchers ask people what one thing they could do that would be the most effective way to save energy. And survey says people said turning off the lights.
Well, that makes sense. What's wrong with that?
Well, turning off the light and other curtailment activities, as researchers like to call them, may not save as much energy as we like to think. A better choice might be making efficiency improvements, like installing more energy-efficient light bulbs or driving non-gas guzzlers.
So what are the things, Adrian, we do that we think save more energy than they actually save?
Well, so there's turning off the lights.
Yeah.
There's driving slower on the highway, maybe stepping it down to 55. People think that saves more energy than it actually does. Unplugging your phone charger. Again, these things do save energy, but not as much as people guess.
And what do we underrate? What saves more than most people think they save?
Driving cars that get better mileage, using room air conditioners instead of central air, and running more efficient appliances.
Are there any thoughts, Adrian, as to why the misconception is out there, why people overestimate the energy savings of some choices and then they underestimate the savings of others?
One explanation that makes a lot of sense to me is that doing things like driving less, turning off the lights, changing the thermostat are all activities that are free or save money. On the other hand, new light bulbs cost money up front. New appliances or a new car cost a lot of money, and they're just a bigger commitment. One of my favorite findings in this study is those of us who do things like turn off the lights and unplug our chargers actually have less accurate perceptions of energy use and energy savings than people who don't.
Why is that?
Well, one theory the researchers propose is that those of us who do turn out the lights are unrealistic optimists about the impact of our choices on the environment.
All right. Marketplace's sustainability reporter Adrian Hill with us here in the studio. Adrian, thanks.
Thank you.
Companies are catching on to social media as a way to market themselves. But beware the risk of online PR disaster.
Oof.
From WLRN in Miami, Kenny Malone tells us one approach companies can take should Facebook turn unfriendly.
2 weeks ago, AT&T sent a special message to nearly 10 million of its customers. Thanks for choosing us. We already cover 97% of America. And then the company went on to announce billions of dollars in network upgrades, without addressing some common complaints about dropped calls and coverage gaps. At the end, the email invited customers to post comments on the company's Facebook wall. Thousands did, mostly negative. And so we present AT&T's Facebook wall, a dramatic reading by Gable stage actors Greg Wiener and Aaron Joy Schmidt.
Service in Alabama sucks.
iPhone sucks.
AT&T sucks.
OMG! I really hate dealing with AT&T.
Seriously, though? You.
The effort is what it is. It's basically emphatic response.
Chris Baucus oversees AT&T's Facebook response team. They have more than 24 people dedicated to social media, but they don't take down angry posts. They respond to them rationally and kindly.
People don't really expect a response when they do leave some obscene kind of comment like that. But you want to see why that person really said what they said.
In the hours after AT&T sent their special message, Facebook posts jumped fivefold. You can look back and still see AT&T responding as late as 4 a.m. that night. And that's one approach. Some companies like BP remove vulgarity. Others like McDonald's and Disney limit a user's privilege to post. But those consumers...
They're commenting anyways,
says marketing consultant Bruce Turkell.
If you don't provide them with the wall in this case or any other opportunity, do you think therefore they're going to be quiet? People are going to get their message out, whether they spray paint it on a wall, a real wall, or they type it onto a Facebook wall.
Turkell says AT&T is doing exactly what they should be, intervening instead of trying to interrupt.
What are you going to do? Sue somebody? Put out a cease and desist? By the time the message has been picked up in the viral space and repeated, it's out of your hands. It's out of your control.
Turkell says social media marks the end of an era for companies, an era when controlling the message was even an option. In Miami, I'm Kenny Malone for Marketplace.
Listening to the Midday Update for Wednesday, September 22nd. I'm Steve Chiatakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers section at our website, marketplace.org. We're going to get a take now on the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world, and how it affects us here in the United States. The Arctic could become the major hot spot for oil and natural gas. But who owns the rights to the riches thought to be under the Arctic seabed? A major international summit on the issue is today in Moscow, and Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us with the latest. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So who's going to be at this summit, and what are they trying to achieve there?
Well, geologists and officials from countries with Arctic interests will be there. That's the US, Russia, Norway, Canada, and Denmark. Now, they've all laid claim to great chunks of the Arctic Ocean bed. The Russians, you may remember, actually planted a Russian flag on the sea floor. Now, a United Nations commission is going to rule on these claims, but given the potential riches, there's obvious scope for conflict. So today's summit will attempt to create a climate of cooperation and compromise over the Arctic.
What's beneath the Arctic seabed, Stephen? Is it worth all of this?
We don't know for sure, but according to the U.S. Geological Survey, it could hold at 25% of the world's undiscovered oil. There are skeptics who doubt this, but the case for Arctic oil got a bit of a boost today. A small British company, Cairn Energy, said it had struck oil for the first time off the coast of Greenland. It's too early to say whether this is a major find. Environmentalists, however, are not happy. The Arctic is becoming a new battleground for them. They say if there's a major spill in those icy waters, it'll take years to degrade. It'll be much, much worse environmentally than the Gulf of Mexico.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard reporting from London. Stephen, thanks.
Okay, Steve.
A new Parisian drinking fountain opened this week, dispensing both still and fizzy water. The water is drawn from the public supply, then chilled and injected with bubbles, part of an effort to persuade the French to buy less bottled water, as the BBC's Christian Fraser reports.
La Pétillante. It translates as she who sparkles, and it's the first public water fountain in France to inject carbon dioxide into tap water. The average Frenchman drinks 28 gallons of still or sparkling water every year. The vast majority is sold in plastic or glass bottles, which are then thrown away. Anne Lestrade is from the public water company Eau de Paris. She says the idea behind the fountain is to finally wean the French off the bottle.
It's the first in Paris, but also in France. Eau de Paris is offering a public service by making this available to Parisians. It's an innovation that means Parisians who like sparkling water can drink tap water, but fizzy tap water.
The French are the eighth biggest consumers of bottled water in the world, last year producing more than 262,000 tons of plastic waste. Eau de Paris say their public supply of water is safe and environmentally friendly. And the best bit of all, it's free, even with the fizz. In Paris, I'm the BBC's Christian Fraser for Marketplace.
Over in Scotland, there's a big debate over how to continue making the sporran. That's the little pouch the Scottish use as an accessory bag for their kilts. For centuries, the sporran's been made of seal skin. The European Union recently banned the use of seal skin. But a loophole in the law could help save sporran production, as the BBC's Rebecca Singer reports.
Since the ban was introduced, kilt makers in Scotland have had to rely on existing stocks, and they've been reluctantly turning to alternatives like pony skin, rabbit and badger. Duncan Chisholm is the founding member of the Scottish Kiltmakers Association.
There's many other skins that we've used in the past, but certainly in comparison to the seal skin, it's got the beautiful texture, the quality and the lustre to it that many of these other skins just don't have.
But the kilt-making industry is excited about early discussions it's been having with Inuit communities in northern Canada. The EU banned seal products from commercial hunts in order to protect seals from pain and distress. But it also acknowledged the economic and social importance of the seal trade to Indigenous people. So seal skins from the Inuits will be allowed into Europe. But Chisholm warns that even if the deal with the Inuit communities works out, the cost of seal skin sporrans could go up, and the quality may not be quite what his customers are used to. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
And you can learn more about how kilts are made at our website, marketplace.org.
Now, here's a quick way to raise $10,000. Nice to hear in these times. You simply testify to the Boulder, Colorado City Council in your boxers.
Oh.
A Boulder man, you'll be interested in this, Steve, he protested a proposal to criminalize nudity by addressing the council in his underwear.
Yeah.
He was handcuffed and arrested. Mm. He sued Boulder for violating his civil rights. Bingo, city pays him $10,000. He's offered to buy boxers for any council member who will work without pants.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, and finally, for those 33 miners in Chile who were trapped 2,000 feet beneath the Earth's surface, I'm sure we've all heard about mm-hmm. these guys, Chilean officials are offering public relations folks to teach the men how to become more media savvy.
Yes, through closed-circuit television, the miners will receive instructions on things like how to remain poised during an interview and,
sure.
We journalists know this one, how to avoid answering a question.
Oh, yeah. I guess you could say when they're finally freed from that subterranean crevice, Bill, the miners will find comfort in another enclosed space. You know what we call that?
Mm.
The media bubble.
So spacious.
It is. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bill Radke, and this is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.